Then came the day that I had been dreading. One morning, my mistress studied her reflection in the mirror with even more attention than usual, and declared that she was ready at last. In all fairness, I had grudgingly to agree that she had never looked more lovely. It was as though all she had suffered recently had tempered her to a new resilience. The last traces of girlishness, uncertainty, and puppy fat had evaporated from her features, and she had become a woman, mature and composed. "I trusted you, Taita. Now prove to me that I was not silly to do so. Bring Tanos to me." When Tanos and I had parted at Safaga, we had been unable to agree on any sure method of exchanging messages. "I will be on the march every day, and who can tell where this campaign will lead me? Do not let the Lady Lostris worry if she does not hear from me. Tell her I will send a message when my task is completed, but tell her that I will be there when the fruits of our love are ripe upon the tree and are ready for plucking." Thus it was that we had heard nothing of him, other than the wild rumours of the wharves and the bazaars. Once again it seemed that the gods had intervened to save me, this time from the wrath of my Lady Lostris. There was a fresh rumour in the marketplace that day. A caravan coming down the northern road had encountered a recently erected pyramid of human heads at the roadside, not 2 miles beyond the city walls. The heads were so fresh that they were stinking only a little, and had not yet been cleaned of flesh by the crows and vultures. "This means only one thing," the gossips told each other. "This means that Ak-Horus is in the Nome of Aswan, probably within sight of the walls of Elephantine. He has fallen upon the remnants of the clan of Akeku, who have been skulking in the desert since their baron had his head hacked off at Galala. Ak-Horus has slaughtered the last of the bandits and piled their heads at the roadside. Thanks be to the new god. The south has been cleared of the dreaded shrikes." This was news indeed, the best I had heard in weeks, and I was in a fever to take it to my mistress. I pushed my way through the throng of sailors and merchants and fishermen on the wharf to find a boatman to take me back to the island. Somebody tugged at my arm, and I shrugged the hand away irritably. Despite the new prosperity sweeping the land, or perhaps because of it, the beggars were more demanding than ever. This one was not so easily put off, and I turned back to him, angrily raising my staff to drive him off. "Do not strike an old friend. I have a message for you from one of the gods," the beggar whined. And I stayed the blow and gaped at him. "Hui!" My heart soared as I recognized the sly grin of the erstwhile robber. "What are you doing here?" I did not wait for a reply to my fatuous question, but went on swiftly. "Follow me at a distance." I led him to one of the pleasure houses in a narrow alley beyond the harbour that provided rooms to couples, of the same or of mixed gender. They rented the rooms for a short period measured by a water clock set at the door and charged a large copper ring for the service. I paid this exorbitant fee, and the moment we were alone I seized Hughie by his ragged cloak. "What news of your master?" I demanded. And he chuckled with infuriating insolence. "My throat is so dry I can hardly speak." Already he had adopted all the swagger and insolent panache of a trooper of the blues. How quickly a monkey learns new tricks. I shouted for the porter to bring up a pot of beer. Hughie drank like a thirsty donkey, then lowered the pot and belched happily. "The god, Ak-Horus, sends greetings to you and to another whose name cannot be mentioned. He bids me tell you that the task is completed, and that all the birds are in the cage. He reminds you that it lacks only a few months to the next festival of Osiris, and it is time to write a new script for the passion play for the amusement of the king." "Where is he? How long will it take for you to return to him?" I demanded eagerly. "I can be with him before Amon-Ra, the sun god, plunges beyond the western hills," Hughie declared. And I glanced through the window at the sun, which was halfway down the sky. Tanos was lying up very close to the city, and I rejoiced anew. How I longed to feel his rough embrace and hear that great booming laugh of his. Grinning to myself in anticipation, I paced up and down the filthy floor of the room while I decided on the message that I would give Hughie to take back to him. It was almost dark when I stepped ashore in our little jetty and hurried up the steps. One of the slave girls was weeping at the gate and rubbing her swollen ear. "She struck me," the girl whimpered, and I saw that her dignity had suffered more than her ear. "Do not refer to the Lady Lostris as she," I scolded her. "Anyway, what have you to complain of? Slaves are there to be struck." Nonetheless, it was unusual for my mistress to lift a hand to anyone in her household. She must indeed have been in a fine mood, I thought, and slowed my pace. Proceeding warily now, I arrived just as another of the girls fled weeping from the chamber. My mistress appeared in the doorway behind her, flushed with anger. "You have turned my hair into a haystack." She saw me then and broke off her tirade. She rounded on me with such gusto that I knew that I was the true object of her ire. "Where have you been?" she demanded. "I sent you to the harbour before noon. How dare you leave me waiting so long?" She advanced upon me with such an expression that I backed off nervously. "He is here," I told her hastily, and then dropped my voice so that none of the slave girls could hear me. "Talos is here," I whispered. "The day after tomorrow I will make good my promise to you." Her mood swung in a full circle, and she leapt up to throw her arms around my neck. Then she went off to find her offended girls and to comfort them. As part of his annual tribute, the vassal king of the Amorites had sent Pharaoh a pair of trained hunting cheetahs from his kingdom across the Red Sea. The king was eager to run these magnificent creatures against the herds of gazelle that abounded in the desert dunes of the West Bank. The entire court, including my mistress, had been commanded to attend the course. We sailed across to the West Bank in a fleet of small river craft, white sails and bright-coloured pennants fluttering. There was laughter and the music of lute and sistrum to accompany us. The annual flooding of the great river would begin within days, and this expectation, together with the prosperous new climate of the land, enhanced the carnival mood of the court. My mistress was in a gayer mood than any of them, and she called merry greetings to her friends in the other boats as our felucca cut through the green summer waters at such a rate as to deck our bows with a lacy white garland of foam and leave a shining wake behind us. It seemed that I was the only one who was not happy and carefree. The wind had a harsh, abrasive edge to it, and was blowing from the wrong quarter. I kept glancing anxiously at the western sky. It was cloudless and bright, but there was a brassy sheen to the heavens that was unnatural. It was almost as though another sun was dawning from the opposite direction to the one we knew so well. I put aside my misgivings and tried to enter into the spirit of the outing. I failed in this, for I had more than the weather to worry about. If one part of my plan went awry, my life would be in danger, and perhaps other lives more valuable than mine would be at risk. I must have shown all this on my face, for my mistress nudged me with her pretty painted toe and told me, "So glum, Taita? Everyone who looks at you will know that you are up to something. Smile, I command you to smile." When we landed on the West Bank, there was an army of slaves waiting for us there, grooms holding splendid white riding donkeys from the royal stables, all caparisoned with silk, pack donkeys laden with tents and rugs and baskets of food and wine, and all the other provisions for a royal picnic. There was a regiment of slaves in attendance, some to hold sunshades above the ladies, others to wait upon the noble guests. There were clowns and acrobats and musicians to entertain them, and 100 huntsmen to provide the sport. The cheetah cage was loaded on a sledge drawn by a team of white oxen, and the court gathered around the vehicle to admire these rare beasts. They did not occur naturally in our land, for they were creatures of the open grassy savanna, and there was none of this type of terrain along the river. They were the first that I had ever seen, and my curiosity was so aroused that for a while I forgot my other worries and went up as close to the cage as I could push through the crowd without jostling or treading on the toes of some irascible nobleman. They were the most beautiful cats that I could imagine, taller and leaner than our leopards, with long, clean limbs and concave bellies. Their sinuous tails seemed to give expression to their mood. Their golden hides were starred with rosettes of deepest black, while from the inner corner of each of their eyes a line of black was painted down the cheek like a runnel of tears. This, with their regal bearing, gave them a tragic and romantic air that I found enchanting. I longed to own one of these creatures, and I decided on the moment to put the thought into mind of my mistress. Pharaoh had never refused one of her whims. Too soon for my liking, the bark carrying the king across the river arrived on the West Bank, and with the rest of the court we hurried to the landing to greet him. Pharaoh was dressed in light hunting garb, and for once seemed relaxed and happy. He stopped beside my mistress, and while she made a ritual obeisance, he inquired graciously about her health. I was filled with dread that he might decide to keep her by his side throughout the day, which would have upset all my arrangements. However, the hunting cheetah caught his attention, and he passed by without giving my mistress any order to follow. We lost ourselves in the throng and made our way to where a donkey was being held for my Lady Lostries. While I helped her to mount, I spoke quietly to the groom. When he told me what I wanted to hear, I slipped a ring of silver into his hand, and it disappeared as though by magic. With one slave leading her and another holding a sunshade over her, my mistress and I followed the king and the sledge out into the desert. With frequent stops for refreshment, it took us half the morning to reach the Valley of the Gazelles. On the way, we passed at a distance the ancient cemetery of Tras, which dated from the time of the very first pharaohs. Some of the wise men said the tombs had been carved from the cliff of black rock 3,000 years ago, although how they reached this conclusion I could not tell. Without making it obvious, I studied the entrances of the tombs keenly as we passed. However, from so far off I could make out no trace of recent human presence around them, and I was unreasonably disappointed. I kept glancing back as we went on. The Valley of the Gazelles was one of the royal hunting preserves, protected by the decrees of a long line of pharaohs. A company of royal gamekeepers was permanently stationed in the hills above the valley to enforce the king's proclamation, reserving all the creatures in it to himself. The penalty for hunting here, without the royal authority, was death by strangulation. The nobles dismounted on the crest of one of these hills, overlooking the broad brown valley. With dispatch, the tents were set up to give them shade, and jars of sherbet and beer were broached to slake the thirst of their journey. I made certain that my mistress had secured a good vantage point from which to watch the hunt, but one from which we could also withdraw discreetly without attracting undue attention to ourselves. In the distance, I could make out the herds of gazelle through the wavering watery mirage on the floor of the valley. I pointed them out to my mistress. "What do they find to eat down there?" my Lady Lostries asked. "There is not a trace of green. They must eat stones, for there are enough of those." "Many of those are not stones at all, but living plants," I told her. When she laughed in disbelief, I searched the rocky ground and plucked a handful of those miraculous plants. "They are stones," she insisted, until she held one in her hand and crushed it. The thick juice trickled over her fingers, and she marvelled at the cunning of whatever god had devised this deception. "This is what they live on. It does not seem possible." We could not continue this conversation because the hunt was beginning. Two of the royal huntsmen opened the cage, and the hunting cheetahs leapt down to earth. I expected them to attempt to escape, but they were tame as temple cats and rubbed themselves affectionately against the legs of their handlers. The cats uttered a strange twittering sound, more like a bird than a savage predator. Along the far side of the brown, scorched valley bottom, I could make out the line of beaters, their forms tiny and distorted by distance and mirage. They were moving slowly in our direction, and the herds of antelope were beginning to drift ahead of them. While the king and his huntsmen, with the cheetahs on leash, moved down the slope towards the valley bottom, we and the rest of the court remained on the crest. The courtiers were already placing wagers with one another, and I was as eager as any of them to watch the outcome of the hunt. But my mistress had her mind on other matters. "When can we go?" she whispered. "When can we escape into the desert?" "Once the hunt begins, all their eyes will be upon it. That will be our opportunity." Even as I spoke, the wind that had blown us across the river and cooled us on the march suddenly dropped. It was as though a coppersmith had opened the door of his forge. The air became almost too hot to breathe. Once again, I looked to the western horizon. The sky above it had turned a sulphurous yellow. Even as I watched, the stain seemed to spread across the heavens. It made me uneasy. However, I was the only one in the crowd who seemed to notice this strange phenomenon. Although the hunting party was now at the bottom of the hill, it was still close enough for me to observe the great cats. They had seen the herds of gazelle which were being driven slowly towards them. This had transformed them from affectionate pets into the savage hunters they truly were. Their heads were up, intent and alert, ears pricked forward, leaning against the leash. Their concave bellies were sucked in, and every muscle was taut as a bowstring drawn to full stretch. My mistress tugged at my skirt and whispered imperatively, "Let us be gone, Taita." And reluctantly I began to edge away towards a clump of rocks that would cover our retreat and screen us from the rest of the company. The bribe of silver to the groom had procured for us a donkey that was now tethered out of sight amongst the rocks. As soon as we reached it, I checked that it carried what I had ordered, the water skin and the leather bag of provisions. I found that they were all in order. I could not restrain myself, and I pleaded with my mistress, "Just one moment more." Before she could forbid it, I scrambled to the top of the rocky outcrop and peeped down into the valley below.